There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, a couple of things. One, you can't have missed it if you live somewhere in the continental United States and any of its territories, or the other two states. The Democrats won control of the Congress, and that's going to mean some changes in telecom, probably. We'll talk a little bit about what that might be as well. You may have heard of a thing called YouTube. User-created video, or consumer-generated video, is a big thing right now. I'd like to talk a little bit about it from an independent media maker's perspective. That's all on today's Media Geek. You will want to stay tuned. And so the Democrats are busy picking their leadership in both the Senate and the House. They've gone ahead and picked their Senate leader and their Speaker of the House. But now it's time to populate the various committees. And the committees are where the real action happens, especially when it comes to media and telecommunications. In the House, it's the House Energy and Commerce Committee. It's the Senate Commerce Committee in the Senate. Been run by Republicans, and that ends come the new year. Now, we do have a lame duck session, as it's known, going on right now, and there's been many, many telecommunications issues waiting for action all year long. The House passed what is known as the COPE Act, which approved what is called a national franchise for cable television, allowing the likes of AT&T and Verizon to start offering cable television services over their broadband internet lines nationwide without negotiating with local municipalities. The Senate has not passed its version of the same bill. Has not had as much of an easy time. Senate Democrats tried to put forward provisions to ensure network neutrality, a free and open and fair internet, into that bill. That didn't pass the Senate Commerce Committee. In fact, it failed by a tie, which means they had a few more Republicans on their side than they did in the House. But nevertheless, it did not pass the Commerce Committee, did not make it into the final bill. But that bill has not made it to the Senate floor, and by all looks of it, it doesn't look like it's going to make it to the floor during the lame duck session, because it's not really sure that the Republicans have the 60 votes they need to ensure they can pass it and bypass any holds or any filibusters put on by the Democrats. So it looks as though there is some possibility that network neutrality has more life left in it in the Congress. As well, it looks as though opposition to the national franchise might also have some more life in the Congress and may have more difficulty passing in a new democratically controlled Congress. In the Senate Commerce Committee, all indications are that Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii will be the new chair. He is the ranking Democrat on that committee at the moment. And on other matters, he had said that he would like to see a delay in the approval for the proposed merger between AT&T and Bell South, which would go on to create the largest telecommunications company in the United States, looking a lot like the old Ma Bell. Right now, regulatory approval for that merger is still sitting at the Federal Communications Commission because it looks like they have a deadlock of 2-2 in with regard to approving that merger. It's already passed the Justice Department, which provided absolutely no provisions on it whatsoever, which is even different than the prior merger that AT&T had last year when it joined up with SBC, when there were several provisions placed on that particular merger. The Justice Department wants to place none on its acquisition of Bell South. The FCC leadership, in the form of Kevin Martin, would like to see it also passed with very few provisions. But the Democrats, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein on the FCC, would prefer to see many more protections for the public interest, for pricing, and for network neutrality rolled into their approval. Now, normally, you would not have a problem between the Republicans and the Democrats if you're a Republican, because there are three Republicans and two Democrats when the Republicans rule the executive branch. But one of those Republicans, Robert McDowell, he's a new member this year, has recused himself from the vote because he used to work on behalf of the lobbyists for all the small competing Bell companies, telephone companies that compete with the large Bells like Bell South, AT&T, and Verizon. And in fact, those small companies oppose this merger and think it's going to be bad for competition and bad for their business. So McDowell preferred not to vote, although Kevin Martin, the chair, is allegedly putting pressure on him and trying to find a way in which it would be okay for him to vote on this issue so that he could have a Republican majority. So that means Republicans have to wheel and deal more with the Democrats, which I'm sure they're not so happy about doing in the first place. We'd like to see way more public interest provisions put into a Bell South AT&T merger. And that's why that merger has not yet gone through the approval process at the FCC, although it has been put on the agenda many times. And speaking of the FCC, Kevin Martin, the chair, was approved, or shall we say confirmed, by the Senate on the 15th of November in an evening voice vote. We didn't have a lot of sense that he would not be reapproved, although many Democrats and public interest advocates harbored fantasies of Kevin Martin not being re-upped. He has shown a bit more competency and political savvy than than the previous chair, Michael Powell. A little bit better ability to work with the Democrats on that committee, even though he is still pushing for what is a loosening of regulations on media ownership and other issues all around, as it happens to be. And one of those big issues, as we recall, is media ownership and the restrictions that currently exist and are set to be revised. And the FCC is it's currently taking reply comments, and those are comments responding to comments that were submitted running up to the October 22nd deadline. There's a deadline, second deadline of November 22nd for your reply comments. And that's where you may still, as a member of the public, say what you think about loosening the media ownership restrictions. One of the big ones that's on the chopping block, possibly, is a restriction on cross-ownership of newspapers and television stations, where large companies like Tribune would love to be able to have combined newsrooms and own newspapers and televisions together. It would certainly put a big cost savings in their budget, but a lot of people think that's not really the best thing for the public interest, especially as we've seen the effects of consolidation already take effect in the newspaper business, in the TV business, and especially in the radio business. That's one of the things on the chopping block. Now, having a Democratic Congress does not necessarily change what happens at the FCC, although the Commerce Committee is the committee which oversees the FCC. It's not a direct oversight. They certainly don't give orders. And the FCC is appointed by the executive, confirmed by the Senate. And so the FCC can still plunge forward, but it is a different political environment with Democrats at the helm. And although some pretty rotten legislation, like the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which radically loosened radio ownership rules, creating the likes of Clear Channel, was passed during the Clinton administration. So we can see that Democrats are not immune to the siren song of the telecommunications industry and the media industry. On the whole, Democrats tend to be critical of further media consolidation. Over in the House, it looks like Representative John Dingell of Michigan is going to be the chair of the House Commerce Committee. And Representative Markey of Massachusetts is likely to be the chair of the Telecommunications Subcommittee. Both of those men are avowedly liberal, as well have been definite thorns in the side to both the media and telecommunications industry. Markey, in particular, been an outspoken proponent of network neutrality, an outspoken opponent of further media consolidation, and having those two men at the top of these important committees over in the House will change the dynamics there as well, and mean that it's much more likely that there will be congressional oversight to whatever the FCC does with regard to media ownership rules. However, if we look back to 2003, when the FCC made their first crack at loosening media ownership rules, and did so against immense public outcry against what they were doing, and without holding any major amount of hearings or asking for public input in a direct sort of way, they got slapped not just by Democrats, but also by Republicans, including Trent Lott of Mississippi. Because when it comes to some of these media ownership issues, a lot of conservative groups, including a lot of Christian conservative groups, are also worried that media consolidation, corporate media consolidation, it does not help their cause, and as well as many liberals and many people on the political left feel that media consolidation does not help their cause. So this is something that does cut across, although at the moment there's been a lot less public outcry that is palpable about media ownership than there was in 2003. One might argue that in 2006 we've had too many telecommunications issues. We have media ownership, we've had network neutrality in the mix, along with the backdrop of the Iraq War. There's a lot of things to keep people mobilized about, but a Democratic Congress looks like it will help quite a bit. And speaking of media ownership, one quick note is two quick notes, actually, is that Clear Channel is going to be bought by a private equity firm. Clear Channel, largest owner of radio stations in the country, with 1,200 stations nationwide, and be taken out of the public stock market is an interesting move to be seen there. And one might see that as a response to the regulatory environment where Clear Channel has been pushing the FCC and petitioning the FCC to further loosen radio ownership restrictions, although there doesn't seem to be a high likelihood of that happening, and Clear Channel has seen their stock market fortune steadily decline throughout the 2000s after peaking in the 1990s during its spending spree. Another media company that's looking to sort of change its ownership dynamics is Tribune, which, according to the Los Angeles Times, is trying to sell its largest television properties in places like Los Angeles and Chicago, where it owns WGN and also owns the Chicago Tribune. Now, that is a duopoly. That is a co-ownership, cross-ownership between a newspaper and a television station there in Chicago. However, that duopoly predates the cross-ownership ban passed by the FCC. Therefore, it was grandfathered in. Tribune has been probably the largest voice trying to urge the FCC to get rid of the cross-ownership ban, and has pushed the most to be able to go on acquiring more television stations and more newspapers, but has also seen its fortunes failing in the middle of the 2000s here. And I wonder if it isn't a sign that the management of the Tribune Company is also not feeling very optimistic about seeing their fortunes change in the regulatory front, if they're not optimistic about seeing that cross-ownership ban either eliminated or loosened significantly enough for them to increase these ownerships. It may also be that they do not realize the profits and gains from cross-ownership that they had expected to reap. In fact, their ownership of the Los Angeles Times is something that happened as an acquisition just a few years ago, along with their ownership of TV stations in the Los Angeles area. And it may be that consolidation, while being bad all around, may not be all it's cracked up to be for those who own. This is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. How is that part right there? The critical examination of our media environment. Taking a look around, trying to survey, and I'll probably be talking a little bit more about the new environment with the Democratic regime here and get some folks who are in Washington and know a little bit more than I do about that in the studio to talk about it in the coming weeks and months as well. I hope to have my usual year-end roundup with my pal John Anderson from DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minute, which is a 5-minute weekly news broadcast about the intersection of media and democracy. John, I've been doing that, I think, since I started the show back in 2002. And I'm always interested in hearing his perspective. And I'm sure you'll have some nice things to say about pirate radio, which we haven't talked about much in a while as well. So you can find a little bit more of what's going on. These are things to look forward to in the next few weeks and months here on the Media Geek Radio Show. My name is Paul Riesemann. I am your host here. And check out Media Geek Online. Please do so at MediaGeek.net. That's the Media Geek blog where I update on a regular basis things that are going on, things that I think are interesting, and stuff that I don't have time for on the program. Of course, this program is available online at radio. Well, that's not supposed to be on. At radio.mediageek.net for download and for podcast. And next, the consumer-generated video revolution. After this, do stay tuned. And that's a little bit from the Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum. Their album is called Grand Opening and Closing. It's a re-release of their 2001 album, re-released now in 2006 on The End Records. So, user-created video. Of course, most people, if you've checked any news in a while, have heard about Google, the big search engine giant of the internet, buying YouTube, which just during 2006 became the go-to video portal of the internet. It's the website that makes it easy for average folks to upload and share video and become the place to look for everything from old commercials to videos of Coke bottles exploding with minty freshness after people drop Mentos in them to, up until recently, sketches from The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. And that got people thinking a lot about this so-called user-generated content revolution. A couple weeks ago, I was at a conference called Streaming Media West, which I go to for my day job as someone who works in digital media for higher education. And it's an interesting place to go because I do get to see the inside of this, what is called the streaming media industry, the industry of online audio and video, how it's served and how it's put together, and to see how some of these minds are thinking about these things. And that was certainly the topic at the top of everyone's agenda, regardless of the session you were in, was talking about user-generated content, talking about the YouTubes. And then, of course, you know, this has a bit of the flavor of the, or a bit of the scent of the flavor of the week, the trend of the month. And you wonder whether there's any there, but there's no doubt about that YouTube, I look at it because I find interesting videos there, or people direct me to interesting videos there, is certainly something. But for those of us who've been involved in independent media for a while, especially going back to the last 6 years, remember that this is not a new idea. If we go all the way back to 1999 in the Battle of Seattle at the WTO meeting, ministerial that happened there, that was really the start of the user-generated content revolution, where the first indie media website, www.indiemedia.org, was put online so that people who were there at the protests and in the streets would be able to go back to centers or any place there was a broadband internet connection and upload audio, pictures, and video from the streets. And that was revolutionary idea that brought together a lot of the ideas of public access TV, of community radio, of a lot of the alternative press, alternative newspapers, and zines, the idea of individuals and average people making their own content, not for to be distilled by the mainstream media, but to be distributed unfettered, uncensored, unedited. That was pretty revolutionary, and was treated as revolutionary, both by a lot of people in the mainstream press, even those who might have who were also on the same page as critical of the protesters at the Battle of Seattle, and largely successful in creating a different viewpoint about what went down on the streets, aside from what was simply being reported on mainstream television and mainstream newspapers. And indeed, that was a big part of what is the indie media movement, which is now going on to going on to 7 years strong, coming up at the end of November, with independent media centers all over the world and cities all over the U.S. and every continent, I think, except for Antarctica. So this is not a new idea, but it certainly is a new idea where people think they can make money. And I think it's interesting to take a look at this issue because... YouTube is not the only company to attempt this. It's the only company so far, I think, to exceed in large commercial terms. And in this case, large commercial terms means get a big audience and then get bought by Google, because there's no indication that they're otherwise making a profit. But certainly Google and Yahoo and America Online and other large internet providers have attempted to get into that space. And what's also interesting is that Google Video and YouTube have also become used by people doing independent media work of the type that is otherwise uploaded to indie media websites. On last week's interview with George Salzman and Nancy Davies down in Oaxaca, Mexico, they made direct reference to the fact that videos taken during the shooting of indie media journalist Brad Will in Oaxaca, Mexico, a couple of weeks ago, were available on Google Video. And so you have to ask, well, why is that? Why are they available on Google Video? Why is that something which is not necessarily immediately on the websites of indie media? And it is a good question to ask, and how this concept has been commercialized in this time, and commercialized with almost no memory of where it began there in the indie media movement. And if I were to proffer an answer, one of the big ones is a simple one, but one that we often don't think about, and that's bandwidth. And that to make all these things go, to be able to provide video of any reasonable quality over the internet, requires bandwidth. And bandwidth requires money. So to get that good user experience of being able to see the video relatively quickly after clicking play on a player, the person at the other end with the server has to be spending a fair amount of money to deliver it to you. On top of that, you have to have broadband. And certainly the penetration of broadband in the United States between 2000 and 2006 has also changed. I know for myself, in 1999, during the first independent media center in Seattle, I did not have broadband at home. I connected to the internet with a modem, and video was an excruciating experience. I'll admit that I watched most of the videos, with the few videos that are up there, and listened to most of the audio that came through at the office, where I had a broadband connection at the university. So we do have these two dynamics, in that it becomes increasingly expensive to host all of this content, and certainly the folks at YouTube know this, while at the same time, your audience has to be there. And we have, I think, the confluence of two factors of there being lots of people with... broadband internet on top of the ability to pay for the, and certainly bandwidth costs and the cost of hosting video, hosting audio, and doing these things on your internet continues to go down, all things considered. It doesn't mean that it goes away. And when you talk about a very radical, nonprofit enterprise like Indie Media, continuing to fund the access to bandwidth, and internet is an ongoing issue and an ongoing problem. On top of that, you do see a difference with YouTube and user experience. YouTube is a video-only site. You click on a video, it pretty much just starts playing because it uses an embedded player called Flash. And most people have a Flash player because it's what you get. Lots of enhanced websites use them. Lots of little video games use them. It's used for so many different things, including cartoons and movies on the net, that most people have this downloaded. It doesn't have to open up something like a Windows Movie Player or a Real Player or a QuickTime Player, which not everybody has. And so it's been this confluence of making things very easy, but you can see it's being made easy and being done in the commercial world. The question then, the big question for us to think about who are involved in independent media is this a good thing, one, and two, is it something which can be used by independent media? Certainly at the moment, the fact that videos of what's really going on in the streets of Oaxaca can be distributed by Google Video and by all indications are not being censored by Google Video is a good thing to be able to when you talk about just the end result of being able to distribute this stuff at, you know, virtually no cost to the person who produced it or wants to distribute it is a good thing. But of course, it's being paid for by advertising. And if anyone's looked at the way Google does their AdWords, the results can often be ironic. You can you're doing AdWords and you uploaded a video that was critical of Coca-Cola, it may be very likely that the ad that comes down the AdWords will be for Coca-Cola or for Coca-Cola memorabilia or other items. You'll get that irony there. And we're still in the heady days when a lot of money is being thrown Google's way and will probably be thrown YouTube's way. And it seems as though this is great. It's a great open field here to be able to distribute this video. Isn't it wonderful? But we also have to think about where it is and who's distributing it and how quickly that might be undermined. How quickly that might be taken down. Although Google has had a motto of don't be evil, when they went to China, they're willing to censor the results of their search engine much more for a Chinese audience in order to meet with government guidelines and government censorship, things they do not do in the U.S. And I'm not about to say that Google is going to be easily skewed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but there are commercial pressures, and we wonder whether or not that will have any effect as we place our trust on large companies, publicly traded, like Google and Yahoo, which are becoming in some ways the new media giants who are succeeding and having much better luck with their profits than the older media giants like Clear Channel, Tribune Company, and on and on. I throw these out as questions, because I don't know the answers. But I think it's worth for us to think about where our independent media is going to be on the internet as we move forward with more video and more audio. We want to be able to distribute. We want to be able to have it out there. But we do need to think about what the means will be, who owns them, who controls them, and where they will continue to be available to us. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.